This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 1-888-408-6141. That's 1-888-408-6141 or tryzona.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Very much looking forward to this conversation today with one of the foremost authorities on vaccine safety. He is a frequent contributor here on Intelligent Medicine on my previous the previous incarnation of Intelligent Medicine, Health Talk. He's Dr. Larry Pilevsky. He's one of America's foremost integrative pediatricians. He's a board-certified pediatrician. He's also very much sought-after lecturer and published author. You can find his articles at drpilevsky.com. And we can focus on a lot of things because he is an expert on integrative pediatric care, which in itself is a very fascinating field. But today I want to focus on something which I get a lot of questions on during my radio program and via email on our Q&A podcasts, which is about vaccine safety. This, that, and the other vaccines. Should you take the vaccines? Are they okay? Is there aluminum, mercury in the vaccines? What's the status in terms of vaccine safety? So Dr. Pilevsky is with us today. He's received his medical degree from the NYU School of Medicine in 1987, and he completed a standard pediatric residency at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City and a fellowship at Bellevue Hospital, NYU School of Medicine. It's so interesting because that's where I was a few years earlier. That was quite the battleground. You were in the belly of the beast, as I was in conventional medicine. And then we both kind of took a little bit of a divergent career path. You focusing on children's care, I focusing on sort of general practice of internal medicine. You have some very controversial views on vaccinations, but very well researched. I've always looked at your work on, in the subject, and it's not just based on sort of irrational fear or prejudice, but you've done your homework. So, you know, let's start out by posing the question. You know, many studies are now saying that vaccines are safe. That's what the scientific community is telling us. That's what pediatricians are telling us, that there's no problem here. Just move along, folks. Nothing to see. Right or wrong?
Well, first, thank you for having me on this evening. And, you know, it's very interesting how people get their information and how people arrive at knowledge. And for those people who say vaccines are safe, even the medical doctors who unequivocally declare vaccines are safe, for the most part, they're getting their information from what they're told. And, you know, a lot of the families that I work with and practitioners in many different fields, including medicine, who are waking up, are realizing that the information that they're told isn't necessarily all the information that there is to gather. And so those of us who have actually dug into the deeper areas of the scientific literature have and who have explored it, read it, researched it, examined it, gone deeper than what we're told, we have found that pretty much the vaccines are not safe, and they've never been truly tested for safety. And recently, the American Academy of Pediatrics wrote a blanket letter to Donald Trump, basically saying that we have a bevy of literature to demonstrate the full extent of vaccine safety and vaccine effectiveness. And, you know, I know that there's not one study that they can actually show that examines the true safety of the ingredients that are in the vaccines. If you look at the actual individual ingredients, some of them are actually prohibited by the toxicological guidelines to never be injected into the human body. And there are others that are never even tested in single injection into the body. So how can you say that a product that's injected into the body is safe if the individual ingredients have not been tested on their own, singularly, to be injected into a human being with a proper control group, and then doing two of the chemicals together, or three of the chemicals together, or even four of the chemicals together? And so here are the data right now. 1 in 6 children with neurodevelopmental disabilities, and that comes out of a 2008 study. We're in now February of 2017.
And we're talking about autism spectrum disorder, and we're talking about attention deficit disorder and other types of problems?
Right. I mean, it encompasses a number of neurological developmental issues that children are having.
Learning disabilities, that kind of thing.
Learning disabilities, seizures, ADD, ADHD, autism, pervasive developmental disorder, sensory processing disorder, speech delay, auditory processing issues, just a whole bevy of diagnoses that are on the neurological spectrum of disability. Mm-hmm. So that's 1 in 6 as of 2008. 1 in 20 children under the age of 5 have seizures. That's as of January of 2016. 1 in 10 have ADD, ADHD. 1 in 68 supposedly with autism, and that varies. Boys tend to be autistic more than girls at a ratio of 3 to 1, 4 to 1, or even 5 to 1. You have 23.5 million to an estimated 50 million adults and children with autoimmune diseases. You have 54% of children with at least one of 20 chronic illnesses as of a study that was published in 2011 based on data from a survey in 2007. And so something's happening to the immune system, the nervous system, and the brains of our kids. And no one is interested. And mostly what I was taught in medicine is you don't really search for the etiology or the reason for the problem. You just find the drug or the treatment that's going to take care of the problem so it goes away. Mm-hmm. Well, if you actually step back and say, well, why are the brains of our kids in disarray? Why are they unable to sit still, talk? Why is their tone low? Why are they losing coordination? Why are their visual fields off? Why are there auditory processing issues? Why do they have sensory processing issues? Why are they having seizures? What's going on with their brains? And all you have to do is very simply, you know, you don't need to be a biochemist or a toxicologist to read it and understand it. You just have to be someone who thinks. And if you look at the ingredients that are in vaccines and you read about their chemical profiles, they enter the brain. And anything that enters the brain that doesn't belong in the brain will cause inflammation. And studies are clearly showing that inflammation in the brain, especially at times when the brain is developing rapidly, will cause a halt in development so that the brain immune system can take care of the inflammation. And once the inflammation is abated and slows down and quiets, then the brain development proceeds. But often the brain development actually doesn't pick up where the problem was. It picks up later on. And so you lose a gap of brain development, of actual white matter that is inflamed and there's like a hole in it. And these studies have been shown in the animal studies to very clearly lead to motor problems and learning problems. Well, that's what we're seeing in 1 in 6 kids, motor problems, learning problems. And so it doesn't take a rocket scientist to examine the ingredients, realize that they've never been studied when they've been injected into humans, and then read about the chemical profiles and realize that they are directly infiltrating across the blood-brain barrier into the brain.
Well, you know, there's lots of alarm these days about vaccine refuseniks. You know, you read articles which claim that because of people who are casting aspersions about vaccines, more and more quote, enlightened upscale parents, like parents, say, in Marin County and upscale parts of the country where they shop at Whole Foods and eat organic foods, more and more withholding vaccinations. And we're seeing a comeback of certain disorders that were thought to be things of the past, like mumps, whooping cough, measles. And it's been described as a dangerous parenting trend. So what say ye to that criticism?
Okay. So first of all, the upward trend of pertussis began in the mid-1990s. And that was before we changed the whole cell pertussis vaccine to the acellular pertussis vaccine. So in 1997-98, we started using the acellular pertussis vaccine. And it really didn't get into practice fully until the early 2000s. But the cases of pertussis had already begun to rise in the mid-1990s, from 1994 to 1997. And this was, again, before the change in the vaccine, and the vaccination rates for pertussis were at least 95% at that time. So everyone wants to attribute the change in incidence of pertussis to unvaccinated kids, when in fact there's a greater than 95% vaccination rate against pertussis. And then they want to attribute the rise in pertussis illness to the acellular pertussis vaccine, and there is an attempt by the powers that be to bring back the cellular whole cell pertussis vaccine, which in fact it was well known to contribute to encephalitis and encephalopathy, and that's one of the reasons that it was taken out of the schedule. But nobody, at least nobody in the forefront, many of us in the background and many parents as well as practitioners have understood that the reason we're seeing resurgences in pertussis is because of bacterial mutation. And that's what happens in vaccinations, similarly to what happens with the massive use of antibiotics. You are going to get mutations of microorganisms. That's what's happening.
That's an interesting contention, because I read an article, I think it was from 2015 in the Washington Post, something to the effect that in chickens, they vaccinate them, of course, because chickens have terrible viruses that are confined to chickens usually, but wipe out chicken populations. And what they discovered is that there's some imperfect chicken vaccines that after a while, the viruses, just like bacteria, mutate to work around the immunity that the vaccine confers.
Correct.
And that they can make the viruses more dangerous,
virulent.
Is that a possibility with some of the things we're vaccinating kids against?
Well, it's not just a possibility. It's a truism. One of the reasons that the Prevnar vaccine, which is the pneumococcal vaccine that we give to kids, it used to be PCV7, and then it was increased to PCV13. Now, Streptococcus pneumonia bacteria have about 90 serotypes, 90, 93 serotypes. And when we were vaccinating against 7, we started to see an upsurge in the incidence of pneumococcal illness from some of the other bacteria that weren't in the vaccine.
Yeah.
And so the serotypes were expanded to 13.
Now it's Prevnar 13.
Correct, Prevnar 13. And you know, the same thing happened when the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine was finally implemented in 1989. It started in 1985. It was not a perfect vaccine. They had to redo the vaccine. And by 1989 to 1991, it was fully implemented, and it was a different vaccine. And then in the 1990s, you started to see other cases of Haemophilus influenza, non-B. Some were A, some were F, some were G. So you started to see a shift. And that's the thing that is most lost in the scientific community, is the thought process that recognizes that any pressure that's put on a microorganism is going to create a reaction. And most often, you cannot eliminate the existence of a microorganism. It's impossible. It is completely impossible to eliminate the existence. Just because you don't see the expression of it doesn't mean that the microorganism doesn't exist. And so we started to see the mutations of the microorganisms. And even in 2003, the Institute of Medicine very clearly stated, we do not know the impact of our vaccination program on the serotype shifts that occur in the microorganism communities. And that is true. And so when people hear that, you know, the reason for an outbreak is because of an unvaccinated kid, I mean, that's actually poorly thought through, because the vaccinated population, A, is supposed to be protected, and B, the vaccinated population is believed to no longer carry the organism because they've been vaccinated. And that's not true. It's actually next to impossible to stop the human being who's vaccinated from carrying the microorganism.
That was actually the thought in the chicken studies, that chickens could catch and carry the virus and then impart it to the other chickens, even if they were vaccinated.
Correct. So I mean, we have a study in baboons that showed that despite vaccination, they still harbored the pertussis bacteria in their airway. Mm-hmm. Why? Because pertussis comes from the air.
Yeah.
You can't vaccinate the bacteria out of the air.
Well, you know,
it can't disappear.
While we're on the subject of pertussis, you know, there's some clever ads on TV, which are really, they're real zingers, because they sort of put the guilt on grandparents. You know, a lot of grandparents out there, and the grandparents, of course, want to, you know, cuddle their grandkids. And the thought is that by the time you reach, you know, 55 or 65, your immunity to pertussis when you got the vaccine has worn off for baby boomers. And so they're trying to enlist this population to get the vaccine to protect their little kids from the big bad wolf, which personified, you know, the whooping cough,
bad wolf.
And it's great because, I mean, literally, I could see a scenario where parents of little kids aren't going to let the grandparents come over if they don't get vaccinated. So it's kind of insidious, isn't it? And you're saying that potentially they could be carriers regardless of whether they receive the vaccine.
Well, I think the problem in the thinking that you're describing is that the only way for a newborn to be exposed is from people. And that's erroneous, because pertussis bacteria circulate in the air. So anybody who breathes the air is capable of inhaling the pertussis bacteria. And this is where our thinking in our society breaks down, because it's only the transference of bacteria from one person to another that's believed to be the way the bacteria get into your body. And people forget that there's another vector here, and that's the air, because bacteria live in the air. And so you don't need to be exposed to someone who's carrying pertussis to inhale pertussis into your airway. I mean, the human body has over 100 trillion bacteria and microorganisms, and those bacteria and microorganisms don't get there because you're necessarily exposed to a person or persons. It gets there because you're exposed to the air.
There's a certain hysteria to this vaccine controversy, because anyone who points up flaws in our vaccination program or concerns about vaccination or perhaps the need for research or reconsideration of how we administer vaccines is automatically branded a heretic or a refusenik or someone who's unscientific. It's almost like you know, global warming denial or denial of some deeply ingrained scientific principle that, you know, it's settled science. The debate is over. You know, that whole thing has permeated the vaccine debate.
Yeah, well, you know, I had an excellent medical education at what is lauded as one of the top medical schools in the country at NYU. And one of the things that they taught us was to critically think. And that when you ask a question, you try to come up with an answer that's not biased, that isn't influenced by your desires for the outcomes. And then once you get the outcome, whether you like it or not, you ask another question. And science is about thinking. And anyone who says the science is settled has asked you to stop thinking. And that's
inherently,
no longer science.
Inherently unscientific, because science advances as a process of debate and rebuttal and by fits and starts. And that's how we make scientific progress. And sometimes we question paradigms and make major advances. So, you know, Newtonian physics worked pretty well for a while. And then there was all of a sudden the theory of relativity, and that shot it all to hell.
I think what happens is that once you start saying to stop thinking that the science is settled, you're now dealing with dogma. You're not dealing with science.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. That's well said. So what about this notion of herd immunity? I mean, that we hear that term a lot. And the object is, and I think a model might be, you know, the polio epidemics of the past or the smallpox epidemics, is that we want everybody on the globe to get a vaccination against a certain pathogen. And then we can actually literally, we can make that bug disappear. They say they've got a few vials of smallpox perhaps deeply in deep security at Fort Detrick, Maryland, where they do bacteriological warfare research. You know, but that's it. It's been eradicated. True or false?
Well, false. I mean, a virus cannot be eliminated from existence because a virus is merely a strand of nucleotides. It's either DNA or RNA. And viruses themselves, before they become viruses, are merely pieces of DNA or RNA instructions. And the place where the viruses exist before they replicate is within the genetic codes of animals, humans, plants, or even foods. And so to say that you can eliminate the existence of a genetic code from billions of people around the world and animals and food and plants is preposterous. The DNA instructions of a virus are embedded in the DNA of humans, animals, plants, and food. And so the idea that the reason that smallpox is gone is because the vaccine created the setting for the disease to go away has actually been refuted on many occasions by people who have thought through, done the research, and actually shown that it wasn't the vaccine that actually eliminated smallpox. And the same with polio. In fact, when the polio vaccine was introduced, the initial response in the community was an increased number of people who came down with polio. And no one at the time actually was willing to look at the relationship between DDT poisoning and exposure by the population to the DDT, it being an organophosphate and it being very capable of causing paralysis, including cessation of breathing, which made people need to go into an iron lung. So there's a lot more, you know, in the literature. Most people are not aware that in the governmental data, which, you know, I and others have found, is that when the polio vaccine was introduced in 1955, the number of cases of polio went up. And so what the medical authorities did was they changed the diagnostic criteria by which polio was diagnosed. And so they changed it in such a way that the number of people who had polio no longer had polio because they needed to have different types of presentations. Most polio was 24 hours of paralysis and gone. And then acutely, they were better, 98, 99% of the time. Well, they changed the criteria to the reason, the only way you can have polio is if you have two incidences of paralytic polio that are reported. Well, most polio was acute. It was it was very limited. It didn't extend past 24 hours.
There's a range of severity of the disease, yeah. Expression of the,
Right. And so the number of people who had polio were, you know, automatically going to go down because they were lost to diagnosis. And that's really hard for people who have just taken the information from their authorities to stomach, because if you read past what we were taught, you realize that the story is much more complex and that we may not have had a reduction in polio incidence from the vaccine. We may actually had an increased incidence and a change in diagnostic criteria that allowed for the numbers to automatically go down. The other thing is that the incidence rate and the disease and the mortality from polio had already started to go down before 1955 when the vaccine was put into play. So again, most people again walk around, you know, touting this bravado about how great the polio vaccine was, when in fact there's more complexity to the story.
Okay, on that controversial note, let's pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts, as our audience is aware. Today we're talking to Dr. Lawrence Pilevsky, Larry Pilevsky, who is an integrative pediatrician. He has a practice here in New York. It's on Long Island, correct? And you see patients utilizing nutritional approaches, incorporating osteopathy, cranial sacral therapy, and nutrient support, natural approaches to pediatric disorders. Not eschewing, of course, conventional medicine, because conventional medicine has value. But today we're talking about vaccines and immunization, a very controversial area. When we return, more on the subject of vaccine safety and some questions about our vaccination programs. With Dr. Larry Pilevsky. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.